10 years ago, next month, the 15th of September, 2008, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy protection, what many now take to be the beginning of the financial crisis and the Great Recession. But the next day, the 16th of September, when the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee met, the first item of business was not Lehman. It was not the trouble facing other American institutions like AIG. It was the funding difficulties of European banks. The world, and especially Europe, needed dollars. Out of one crisis came many. The history of those crises is the subject of historian Adam Tooze's new book, Crashed: How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World, published by Viking. Adam Tooze is the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Professor of History and the director of the European Institute at Columbia University. I'm so pleased he can join us now to discuss the past decade of economic and financial upheavals, and frankly, Adam, to explain to me what it all means, because basically, I don't get it. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. So look, this is about all I know about the financial systems and about like stock markets. When things are up, that's good. When things are down, that's bad. Like, I guess I don't want to just throw what does it all mean to you, but what does it all, how can a layperson understand what goes on and how a crisis like this happened?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, things do go up. And
right.
Whilst they're going up, it feels great.
It's seemingly.
And it really does. I think what is important to say for a large part of the population, the upswing in the United States of the 2000s is quite broadly based. If you think about minority populations in particular, this is a moment where they get access to mortgage loans for the first time in many cases. Redlining is being blown away by private lending.
Seemingly, yes.
Seemingly,
yes.
Exactly. And it's precisely those populations also in many cases which are being sucked into new types of borrowing. The idea being that as things go up, you graduate from what is quite a dodgy loan when you start out. But as you build a little equity in the property that you own, then of course things get better. You can refinance and you get your foot on the ladder.
Okay, this so farm was, with you.
Yeah, so
okay.
this is the promise of a boom. And at the other end, of course, you've got the people making tens of millions in the banks who are operating this. You've got the people in the hedge funds making literally billions. You've got people in between, the American middle, upper middle class, who are speculating in the boom states like Arizona and Florida. The majority of loans are going to people with two or three mortgages. So
wow.
These are already people engaged in the whole flipping. You
right.
Remember the cable TV, the midday TV is all about.
I'm obsessed with those shows.
It's a kind of a popular belief that you can get rich, and you can get rich by taking risk and then working hard.
So these are the people who have a little bit more knowledge that are maybe taking
exactly.
more risks, as you're
so
saying.
So this is a really quite a comprehensive mobilization of a society, not just in the US, but very much here. And the question, of course, is what stands behind it?
Right.
How stable is it? Is it, in fact, something that can be made sustainable? Because that's the promise. People are not fools.
They
are looking for a step up.
Right. And more financial security.
Yes, exactly. But the promise is, of course, that you get this by way of leverage, right? It's one thing to save all your life and put your money in a bank.
It used to be one thing when you would get if you put in a CD, you would get a nice little interest.
You would, but even if you did, you'd never really get anywhere.
Oh, really?
The crucial thing to getting rich is to be able to borrow and use other people's money in the business of getting rich.
OPM,
leverage.
Other people's money.
Other people's
That's
money.
The key, huh?
And for regular folks, the only way that you can do that is by buying property. So this is what's unique about a house, is that you maybe borrow three or even four times your income. You take somebody else's money, put it down on the house, then the house gains in value and you get to keep
okay.
the improvement on the entire mortgage. You buy, I don't know, a $400,000 house, you put $100,000 of your own down. You get to keep the appreciation on the whole $400,000. Now, that's
sure.
how all business works. But for regular working people, it's only with regard to real estate that you get that deal to build leverage.
So in a way, once a person does buy a house, it's not necessarily to their advantage to pay off said mortgage.
No, ideally, you would just leverage to the max, right?
Is
if you
that
knew
right?
that all the prices were endlessly going up, the more leverage you build, the more profit you make. And of course, the more people are leveraged, the more demand there is in the market for properties.
Oh, I see. I think I have to make some right? calls and refinance my house.
And so
I'm
then
making
you get
a note
these,
right now.
Yeah, you get these places where people are just piling in and competing with each other.
So how does this, what you just described
yeah.
to me, how did that help bring everything down in 2008?
Well, two mechanisms kick in.
Okay.
So the first is the one that hits the households themselves.
Okay.
And it's exactly the same mechanism, but in reverse. Because as you go down, all the losses hit you too. So you buy a property for $400,000.
Right. Yeah, I like that property metaphor. Yeah,
we'll do with that
metaphor.
One. So you
that's
start
good.
You start with $100,000 of your own. You put $300,000 from the bank
okay.
into a $400,000 property.
Right.
It appreciates to $500,000.
Okay, now you're up $100,000.
So you're up. You've doubled
so
your
speak.
Money. Yeah.
Right. You've
doubled your money, right? What happens the other way around? If the property falls from $400,000 to $300,000, the bank is still owed $300,000.
And
you're down to zero.
So
the leverage effect has a huge effect on the up cycle and a similarly powerful effect on
the
down,
down
cycle. And then remember the social aspect of this. It is the least well-off people who are most dependent on this mechanism. Seriously
on the
wealthy
mechanism going,
of leverage up,
going up.
But then they also take the hit coming down. So if you look at the African-American community, Latino community in the US, they take a huge hit to their wealth. The median wealth of the average black family falls to single-digit thousands, like to derisory levels. The wealth gap has opened up in a way we haven't seen since before the Civil Rights Revolution.
Right.
It is a brutal setback to the people who were promised for the first time the magic of leverage acting in their favor. And now that's just the beginning of the story, because
okay.
then something really bad begins to
happen.
So
we've got that going on.
That's
so
going on.
And why, by the way, were the values going down? What was making values begin to plummet?
Well, at some point you reach the point where it's no longer sustainable, right? At some point, if this is a mechanism driven by how much ordinary folks can borrow, at the bottom of the pyramid of appreciation, there is the family earning $35,000, $40,000,
okay.
stretching to buy a $200,000 property. And at some point when it goes to $250,000, they're out. If they're out, then the people who want to move up can't move up because there's
like
no one to buy.
Effect. I mean,
and
it
then
all
the pancake
to
begins to collapse.
Okay.
And you see it happening first in places like Cleveland, so in the Rust Belt, in areas with large black populations, the housing market shifts into reverse gear already in 2005, 2006. Now, if that is what happened, you would get a recession. This will produce a depressed economy. All those households who have their equity wiped out, they're starting from zero all over
Yikes.
Again. Yikes. But then something else happens.
Okay.
And what turns this into a truly global catastrophe is that as those loans begin to go bad, the question we have to ask is the stability of the people who lent them the money.
I see. So,
and again, the banks who lent them the money take a hit. So you might think, okay, fine. But if it was a question of a big wealthy person lending a bunch of less well-off people mortgages and those mortgages went bad, the big wealthy person would walk away with the loss. But there'd be no drama.
No, because they're still big and wealthy.
There might be law cases, there might be some fraud involved, but that's all it would be. That's the dot-com story. That's what happened in the early 2000s. More people lost more money on dot-com than did on the real estate bust. The difference is who took the loss. In the early 2000s, it was our imaginary wealthy person, effectively, who'd gone into dot-com.
Okay.
In the mortgage boom, it's a bank. And the bank is an inherently fragile thing because the bank is itself leveraged. The bank...
Of course it is, because of the money that it's loaned to people that are then supposed to pay it back.
And where does it get that money from? It borrows it from people.
Oh, my.
So when the bank can't pay back, it can't pay back its own borrowing. And the American, European banks had all moved to a model where they weren't even taking deposits. So once upon a time, we imagined the kind of Jimmy Stewart model
yeah,
of banking.
Right.
People put their money in.
I still think that way.
You can have panics. And so what we have now is federal deposit insurance, which basically tells the depositors you can't lose your money.
Member FDIC.
Yeah, FDIC, invention of the New Deal, because we realized that we needed to prevent panics happening. Because when panics happen, even a properly run bank, which is in every way solvent and a benefit to society by means of providing credit, will fail. Because if everyone pulls their money out simultaneously, it's dead. Any bank is dead.
I'm just going to reintroduce. I'm Nancy Giles. I'm speaking with Adam Tooze, who's the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And I'm surprised because my eyes haven't glazed over. I'm actually grasping some of what you're saying. Now, this is a little shift, but I'm just curious, Adam, how did you get interested in this? Did some profound experience happen to you when you were a child? Someone handed you money to put in a piggy bank, or you saw a man in a suit with a briefcase? Well, how did you get into this whole financial...
Well, it's funny because it isn't really because I'm not into... I'm
it's
terrible at
really...
personal finances.
Are you?
You know,
is it the history? Is
it's
it,
the
it,
history.
The so what got
it's,
you
it's
into
the,
that?
It's the causal relationships. It's the way in which things happen in roundabout ways.
And how did you become interested in telling these stories or finding out what caused these things?
I mean, it could simply be that I grew up, I mean, I was born in England, I moved to Germany in the early 70s, to West Germany. These were both societies which, you know, to me as a middle-aged person now, it's kind of hard to fathom. We were 30 years out from World War II.
What? 30 yeah. years well, you out really felt
War.
It more
and
there,
you feel
I'm
it,
sure.
You felt it viscerally, both on both sides. I mean, my parents were bombed. Like, you know, we were totally shaped. Like, there were bomb craters all over London still in the 70s.
Wow.
And you go to West Germany, and it was a society overcoming, obviously, the problems of guilt and responsibility. And you find yourself enmeshed from childhood onwards in a conversation, really, about the forces that make that kind of catastrophe, that kind of disaster happen. And I've previously worked on, you know, World War One, World War Two, Nazi Germany, and have a lifelong fascination with transatlantic relationships. I spent a lot of time in the US as a kid. I've now worked here for almost 10 years. My family is mixed English American. So that dimension as well, the way in which a world has been made since the beginning of the 20th century, in which the United States and Europe are integrally integrated, and then between them, of course, have radiating effects out across the entire globe, that's really been an abiding fascination.
You know, it's funny, is we in this country, I think we're shielded from a lot of that. We didn't take the same kind of hit that England did or that Germany did. So I can see how that would really dictate your worldview. And speaking of worldview and like the world economy, which I'm not going to get glazed over, but it's something else that I've never quite grasped, and I'm jumping around, so forgive me. Why do we owe China so much money? When did we start borrowing money from China? Or do countries borrow from each other all the time? These are basic things that I'm kind of like, huh?
Yes, and that was really the preoccupation before the financial crisis hit. So, you know, it's often said that no one saw it coming. It's actually in this case more a question of a bunch of people seeing something really bad coming, which didn't happen. And the thing they were obsessed about, economists in the early 2000s, was precisely this question of America borrowing from China.
Right.
And so then the question is, well, who's borrowing from China? I mean, regular Americans don't borrow from China. Well, so how's this happening?
I mean, if I have a friend that's Chinese American and I borrow $10, that's my experience of borrowing from China.
So what Americans do is buy loads of Chinese manufactured goods.
Okay.
And those Chinese manufactured goods have to be paid for somehow.
Right.
And the Chinese take dollars for them, because America is the hub of the world economy. And so if you're a global exporter, whatever it is you make, you're likely, odds are, you get paid in dollars.
Okay.
So then the question is, what are the Chinese going to do with that huge quantities of dollars that they're earning? And they could sell them, which would have the effect of crashing the dollar, adjusting its exchange rate, and then the Chinese would not sell as many things to Americans because they'd be far more expensive for Americans to buy.
Okay, full stop, go back. So what do you mean selling dollars?
So they could go to a foreign exchange market like they have here in London.
Because they can't use dollars
in
China.
No, at home, exactly.
Okay.
Because if you're making, you know, cheap plastic toys for an American box store to sell, your workers are being paid in yuan, not in renminbi, not in dollars. But what in fact happens is that the Chinese government effectively buys the dollars that the exporters are earning off them and then invests those in the United States.
Okay.
And lo and behold, in the early 2000s, there was somebody in the United States borrowing on a very large scale, and that was the US government, to fight the war on terror, to pay for the tax cuts that the Republicans pushed through in the early 2000s. That produces big deficit in the government accounts. And so there are a lot of treasuries, American bonds, IOUs of the American taxpayer out there for the Chinese to buy.
Man.
And they've snaffled those up. That's exactly what the Chinese accumulate. Now, that creates a really kind of fragile situation where a lot of people begin to worry that the Chinese might suddenly offload those. And if they did, you would get a kind of delayed version of the earlier scenario. They sell their dollars into a global market for dollars because everyone wants to buy and sell them for various reasons.
Right.
And the value of the dollar falls very rapidly.
Because there's so many dollars.
Exactly, that they would be unloading this kind of huge dammed up quantity. And then something really bad happens, which is the interest rates change. So if you sell an IOU, you reduce its value. So to get somebody else to take the IOU and lend you money, you have to raise the interest rate that you pay them to hold the IOU. So as the Chinese did this, it would have the effect of driving interest rates in the United States up.
And that's how we ended up being indebted to them?
No, they held us steady and they stayed in the game. And it turned out that they never, in fact, ever did sell them. In fact, they piled on more. Because this entire scenario of people being worried about treasuries, about government borrowing, is a kind of thinking about the world that says it's politicians that are wrong, it's taxpayers you don't want to pay, it's all about the public sector, it's all about government. it turned out that the thing that actually brought America down or threatened to in 07, 08 wasn't the government and wasn't the taxpayer. It was business.
Mm.
It was the private economy. It was capitalism, plain and simple, okay. Having a heart attack.
I'm speaking with Adam Tooze, who's the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And Adam, I got to say, I appreciate your patience because when I initially saw the book, which is, let's see, 600 and where did I write that? 616 pages.
Yeah.
Course, and there are 70 pages of footnotes. And I looked at it and I thought it's not exactly a beach read. Let's put it that way. But you've really been patient in trying to explain like what happened. And I was saying to you during the break, I think a lot of lay people, even with things as simple as, well, a mortgage isn't simple, but a mortgage or getting CDs or getting financial planning, it's hard to grasp all the different ways money can be borrowed, loaned, and invested. And I feel like it's made deliberately hard for people to understand. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's right. At different levels. I mean, it's clear in retrospect that there was really fraudulent mis-selling ahead of the crisis on a very large scale.
Right. And they knew that they were doing that.
Yes. Yeah, which was really obviously disastrous and criminal and totally exploitative. And that's the downside of the expansion of credit in the US economy in this period. There's another level at which I think it's generally true that economists and business people, as it were, live in a world of jargon, and it creates a kind of zone of exclusivity.
Oh, man.
And it gives them enormous power. Economists are clearly the most influential and powerful social scientists that we have at universities, for instance. And then in the book, I kind of almost stumbled. I mean, one has to stumble across it because it's not laid out. A realm of monetary operations and of actions, especially by the US Federal Reserve, which they will insist, and they write to say this, were in no way secret, were in no way hidden from the public, just in no way advertised. Hugely important interventions were made in the course of the crisis that... It really is like a secret handshake. If you go as a historian like me to go and interview one of the actors at the time and say, well, I'm working on the crisis, they just yawn because, you know, everyone's done this. If you say, I'd really like to talk about the liquidity swap lines, all of a sudden they start paying attention.
Aha, you had the secret handshake.
Yeah, because the liquidity swap lines are the secret handshake. This is the realm of the history of the crisis, which... Again, it's crucial to emphasize this. The Fed was in no way misleading anyone. It wasn't pretending to be doing something.
They just didn't tell us.
It just didn't advertise the fact that it extended the realm of its activity to the stabilization of the entire global dollar-based banking system.
All right, now, are they responsible now to advertise such things?
Well, they do now, and the story is a little bit better known than it was. And they have at no point violated any requirement of disclosure. And they... fought a law case against Bloomberg all the way up to the Supreme Court and then conceded and lost and then have revealed. And part of the archive, if you like, for this book is the data which they revealed. They've disclosed more about the so-called liquidity operations they performed than any central bank has ever disclosed.
Wow.
So freedom of information in this case has worked, not in real time, but in time enough to allow us to tell a story about the US we can't tell for the ECB in Europe or the Bank of England in England. Never, UK will never be able to. And the central bankers will say it's important that we don't disclose these details because if you tell the world about how endangered the banks were, it
right.
in fact contributes to their fragility. It's a stigma effect.
Well, but you know, full disclosure is helpful. But information is power.
At certain moments, there is a real concern. So I think it's important to understand why the central bankers withheld this information, the detail that we now have at the time. But that, for me, is the sort of the real. One of the purposes of the book is to try and reveal in a more naked way, if you like, than we've had before, one of the really important decisions that was made and its consequences, really, for the governance of the global financial system. I'm not actually decided one way or the other whether this was a, you know, I'm sure it wasn't a bad thing. In fact, it's crucial for the stabilization of the global economy at that moment. How going forward one thinks about the role of the America's national central bank in relation to global financial capitalism, I think is a question you know, ideally one would have a rational debate about. Under present circumstances, it seems to me quite unlikely that that is the kind of debate that one would have. And so no doubt some of the technocrats who do this kind of thing would rather that we went on not talking about it.
I'm Nancy Giles. I'm speaking with Adam Tooze. We are talking about it. He's the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And we want to hear from you. Maybe you have some questions for Adam. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You know, one thing that I do remember basically from some old econ classes is that conventional measures like GDP would be the things that would indicate to people that the economy is growing, you know. But bankruptcies are way up. You've got people committing suicide. I mean, there's some other things that are happening. So are there new ways to look at and measure how the economy is doing that don't have to do with the more traditional ways?
My sense right now is that more that we're in the process of deconstruction than of reconstruction.
Okay.
We are really coming to appreciate how fragile the set of instruments are that we use conventionally to measure the economy. Historically, they in fact originate in the era of the New Deal. They originate around World War II. Those are the moments where America, like other developed economies, began, and the government of America began to think of the national economy as an object that it could study, it could control, it could govern. And out of that comes most of the economics and come most of the statistics that we still use to measure the economy. That's where the conceptual scheme was laid down. And of course, in the meantime, something called globalization has happened.
Right.
And that has fundamentally transformed the ways in which bits of the American economy, businesses interact with the wider world, how embedded they in fact are in American society. And on the other hand, it has cut a large chunk of the American population loose from national uplift. So if you look at the statistics of income, the median, so the 50% mark, shows very modest, if any, growth for working class men. It's negligible growth since the bicentenary.
I have seen those charts and they're shocking.
It's absolutely shocking. Yeah. Whereas the national economy appears to be, you know, going gangbusters.
Booming.
But it's basically the benefits are being concentrated in the top 10%, and then particularly not even in the top 1%, but in the fraction of 0.1%.
Tiny
fractions.
Income disparity is just, it's shocking.
And the wealth disparity is even more crass. So income is one thing, but wealth is where the real action is.
That's
where the disparities are simply jaw-dropping and getting more so. And what's really striking is that this is in some sense a peculiarly American story. I mean, the trend towards inequality, because it has quite general causes, is seen in most sophisticated, advanced, developed societies, but the net effect after tax, after benefits, and so on in the United States is more pronounced than anywhere else. And so to that extent, we really do have to ask ourselves, you know, do most Americans have an interest anymore in famously growing the pie? The idea has always been stop arguing about how big your share is, just focus on growing the pie, growing the national pie. Well, we've been growing the national pie since the
70s. And it hasn't benefited everybody.
Many people's slices have barely increased at all, not just in percentage terms, but
at all.
They just get a smaller and smaller share of the bigger and bigger pizza.
Yeah. What can an individual do? What can people do on an individual level to I guess educate themselves more and try to, I don't know, shift that trend? I have to say, one of my banks is Chase, a couple of years ago, I think I read that Jamie Dimon was making some incredible amount of money with an incredible bonus, and that was after news of, and I'm totally messing this up, but you know, some big mistakes made with Chase where billions of dollars were lost, and I was, you know, I thought I was going to throw up. I haven't changed my account or anything, but like, what can one person do to rail against?
But I think that's very telling, and it's all our problem. To me, it's analogous to, you know, to fossil fuels and carbon.
Right.
Like, this is a systemically important industry. It's very difficult, you know, it's impossible really to conduct your life without a bank account. The people who operate those are part of this system. And so, and when the system is coming down, as it was in 08, we all do.
We all suffered.
We all do have a huge interest in making sure that it doesn't implode.
Right.
So there's a fundamental dilemma of how we fix this? How, is it possible to fix it? What is the moment to fix it? The moment, obviously, at which, as it were, its political armor cracks open is also the moment at which we actually need just to fix it and repair it.
Right.
So there's a extraordinarily difficult just choices to be made, which the Obama administration decided in favor of caution rather than aggressively going after, for instance, top bankers to punish mm-hmm. them for the consequences of this crisis. And there is always the temptation on the other side that we were talking about earlier, which is the individual pursuit of wealth enabled by the system, promised by the system,
right.
which if it goes well, will indeed allow certain people to achieve uplift. But statistically, if you look at the aggregate, has not provided the average American, the American at the 50% mark, let alone people in minority populations or disadvantaged urban or rural settings, any prospect of uplift much since the 1970s. So the question really is, what are the forms of collective action that would work? Once upon a time, one would have said unionize,
right.
build effective organized labor movements. It's unclear whether or not, against the extremely hostile legal environment which is being currently set up with the Janus decision and so on, that's actually an option for
okay.
people. There's a question of obviously national government level, but then there's the disappointment of the Obama administration, well-intentioned as it was, what was it able to deliver? The single major reform for most people is affordable care.
Right.
And we know how problematic that was and how viciously it's being attacked. So really, I think there's a profound sense of frustration, which to my mind is what, and I think almost everyone agrees, is what we see in the 2016 election. Right?
Yes.
This extraordinary election where, you know, there's the Trump phenomenon on the one hand, and then you have an openly declared American socialist, you know, running as a serious contender for the Democratic Party. This is a remarkable historical development.
Absolutely, sure. We've got a lot of people who want to talk. We've got Adam in Brooklyn. Adam is a high school economics teacher. And Adam, tell me a little about what your question was for Adam.
So I've taught this concept of, like, the recession and what caused it and, you know, the collateralized debt obligations, you know, based on mortgage-backed securities. I've tried to teach this a few times to my students, and it all, like, it kind of works, but I'm wondering if, Adam, you've written anything that's, you know, short, like, for mass media that's shorter than a 600-page, you know, book that could really distill this down that I could give to students so they're getting the information directly from an expert without me kind of fumbling my way through it, since I'm not an economist.
Well, that's
it's difficult, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What would you advise Adam? How can he try to explain to his high school students what the heck is going on?
It's really interesting. So the book, in the book, the chapter that deals specifically with that kind of stuff is about 20 pages long.
Which chapter is that?
Chapter 3, I think, off the top of my
okay.
head. And it's a very compressed treatment of precisely these issues. But I actually think there's a lot of really good material out there. I mean, one of the joys of writing this book was, in fact, feeding off the commentary that came out at the time. There are a number of different websites that you could go to. Maybe we should have this conversation offline and I can provide you with a reading list. But this book grew out of teaching this topic. It's the result of lecture courses given to both Yale and Columbia. And so for me, part of the impetus to write the book was precisely to figure out a way of conveying these basic concepts and the systemic interconnections obviously in that case, a bunch of very bright young students, but nevertheless, people who are often starting from scratch.
Right.
So, I mean, I applaud your ambition. My heart goes out to high school teachers in general. Need a huge shout out. It's a tough crowd.
It is a tough crowd.
You do a crucial job. There is nothing more terrifying for an academic than to go, a university academic, than to go lecture to a bunch of high schoolers. That is such a difficult audience. The sorts of ideas that have worked quite well for me are trying to link it in with other things that people understand. So the magic of a CDO or something like that is a lot like a dice game. and that's, you know, it's like the two dice problem. You know, if you're throwing two six-sided dice, what's the chance of two ones coming up? You know, it's one in 36. If you trying to get seven, it's one in six.
Oh my goodness.
And so that is really what the, you know, the logic of a CDO is based on.
Well, Adam, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you trying to talk us through this today. And the time flew. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Nancy Giles. I've been speaking with Adam Tooze, author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World.